Blog Talk Radio.
Got to give the people what they want. It is, today's date is March 1st, 2011. Washington, D.C., planet Earth's third planet from the sun. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones. Let's get this party started. You know, you grow up as a young entrepreneur, and you decide that you come to the conclusion that you're a pretty good salesman. You start out by selling greeting cards as a kid, door to door, and then. And then you move on to selling vegetable seeds. Again, door to door, as a young man, a young child, a young entrepreneur. And finally, you were able to save up enough money to go to college. You go to college, and one day you're sitting in a restaurant, and you're eating some noodles, and suddenly you have an epiphany. I can do this better. So you convince 11 family members and your closest friends, 11 of your closest friends and family members, to invest in a company that you've created, that you've started. How hard is it to convince family members and friends to invest in a company, a startup? Yet you convince your family members and friends to invest in your small noodle company. The company isn't doing so well as it starts out, and you decide you're going to change some things, and you change a few things here and there and fine-tune a few things, and suddenly your company is a success. Business is booming. You open up locations all over Wisconsin, Chicago, Iowa, Missouri. Your company is doing booming business. And suddenly, you get things running just the way you want it. Everything's clicking on all cylinders. And then, this happens.
What's your name?
My name's Rob.
Rob?
Yeah.
What's your last name?
Lewis.
Lewis,
I'm from Madison. I'm a member of a socialist organization, a revolutionary organization, that talks about how does this system work and how do we change it. And so basically, what we want to do is really, we study history and we try to teach people lessons from history, from events like this, where there's a class struggle between the ruling class and the working class.
How can we implement such a system that captures your ideals?
Sure.
Can we learn from the demonstrators in Cairo as to how to implement such an idea?
Well, actually, we have a meeting tomorrow night. If you want to come and catch with your video, it should be a good talk and discussion afterward. Basically, you can't dictate a revolution. You can't dictate an uprising. It's something that's spontaneous.
My name is Ty Fitzgerald.
My name is Brett. I'm a teacher.
My name is Ben. I'm from a radical collective space in Western Wisconsin.
And I'm a member of the AFL.
I'm a member of AFC Local 3872
in
Madison College.
I am officer at large for the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Came up because this is too big to miss.
You said that the collapse of capitalism and neoliberalism as an ideology was, you know, is ideologically discredited because it showed that markets don't actually work the way that they're supposed to work. And we argued that the response to the crisis of austerity around the world was going to initiate a new era of class struggle. Over the last 6 weeks, it's become clear that time actually is now. From Tunisia to Egypt, now Libya, and now here in the United States.
I feel like we can actually have an effect on that by organizing folks together and actually saying, you know what, we say no concessions, tax the rich, get those tax cuts back. You know, it's not our mess, it's your mess. You clean it up. We shouldn't have to.
Okay.
It's the Koch brothers and those billionaire motherfuckers who have the representatives in the state house who are trying to screw all of us, and we all need to stick together and fight back. And I feel like that means something, that folks start trying, you know, if we can do that, I think that the future bodes well for working people in this country. And
so your noodle company, the noodle company that you started, is a dictatorship because you decide that you want the company to function in a way that makes money.
Racism has been a really important tool in America for suppressing workers because it divides the workers against each other. And so it's also sexism and homophobia is another way to confuse people and think there's someone else, that there's enemies who's actually just on their same side in the exact same position of being exploited.
What would you say about those who would say classism works in the same way?
Well, like I described earlier, there are two fundamental classes that are just a plain fact in society. You either work for someone else or you work for yourself. And most people work for someone else in a way that they aren't free. You don't really get to decide your work. For example, I work at Noodles, a restaurant, and basically it's a dictatorship there. We're told exactly what we're going to cook, how we're going to cook it, what time we're going to get there. And basically, if they don't like what they're doing, they try to tell us what to do. If we don't listen, they get rid of us. And so we're not able to actually cooperate in a way that we make decisions together. I try to convince my fellow employees that we should have a union at Noodles, so the source of power to start with. And then I think in terms of the bigger picture, when you look at revolutions, the way that you actually get rid of any sort of dictatorship is by having workers take control of the place where they work.
Would your plan, your vision for Noodles,
sure,
would it include the owner? What capacity would he be granted?
If the owner wanted to cooperate with us as an equal and provide his skills that he had, we would definitely cooperate with him. We'd have to abdicate his position as being an owner and controller of us, and he would have to recognize that we run noodles together, and basically, if he doesn't want to cooperate with us, he's against us.
Okay, all right, okay. So this young man works for Noodles, the company that another young man started by asking his family members and closest friends to invest. There are a number of useful idiots hanging out in Wisconsin. And they don't want to be told when to show up for their shifts or what to cook at the local noodle shop. They don't think owners should be able to dictate what happens in their own companies. In the video or audio that you just heard, a young employee of the fast food noodle chain complains about the dictatorship of the company that provides him with a paycheck. You either work for someone else or you work for yourself, he said. And most people work for someone else in a way that they aren't free. You don't really get to decide your work, he said. For example, he says, I work at Noodles, a restaurant, and basically it's a dictatorship there. We're told exactly what we're going to cook, how we're going to cook it, and what time we're going to get there. And basically, if they don't like what we're doing, they try to tell us what to do. If we don't listen, they get rid of us, the employee said. Wow, that is radical. Damn those noodle owners. So, let me make sure we understand each other here. The employee continued, and so we're not able to actually cooperate in a way that we make decisions together. He goes on to say, I try to convince my fellow employees that we should have a union at Noodles. So it's a source of power to start with. And then I think in terms of the bigger picture, we need to look at revolutions in a way that you actually get rid of any sort of dictatorship. And by having workers take control of the place where they work. What a tyrant that employer must be. Can you imagine? Can you believe this tyrant employer telling his employees when to show up for work and what they can cook when they get there? What they do as a job at his restaurant? This 24-year-old punk, and he is, he's a member of the ISO. He's a member of the International Socialist Organization. And people wonder, okay, well, what's so bad about being a socialist? The system apparently sucks. It sounds ridiculous because these are the people. They're celebrating the people who are pulling off these revolutions all over the world. They're all screaming about, oh, isn't this great? So let me make sure I understand this. I start a company, or you start a company. J.K. Collins and Company, they sell fashion items, shoes, bags, handbags. J.K. Collins and Company starts her company, and she stocks her shelves with shoes and bags. She hires several employees. She asked that her employees show up for their 10 o'clock workday, 10 until 6, at 9:30 to prep for the onslaught of customers. The employees cooperate that first few weeks, and then one employee decides that, well, I don't really want to show up at 9:30. I'd rather show up at 10:30. And by the way, I don't really want to sell the shoes the way you want me to sell them. Or the handbags, for example, for instance. No, and I don't like the way the handbags are being displayed. And I'm not going to display those handbags the way you want me to display them. I don't think I should have to. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and unionize all the other employees, and we're going to overthrow you, J.K. Collins, because you know what? We want to all work together. And if you won't work with us at your own company, then we're going to overthrow you and take over your company. And we're going to run your company as a collective, because we don't feel that you should be able to tell us what to do and how to run or work at your company. This is the danger of socialism. You just heard it from the young man's own mouth that running the company, well, he just thinks it's a tyrannical situation working for another person. It's tyranny. It's a dictatorship. And so working at the noodle company is not it's horrible. Getting a paycheck, working for a living, this is all a result of President Obama's leadership. President Obama's socialist leadership. Barack Obama.
Darkness had descended all across the land. A lone voice in the distance uttered, yes, we can. He gave good speeches, never sweat. He was real good, I see him from there.
Obama, he's come to save the day. Socialist utopia, here we come. Yeah. The story The story continues. In 2009, I noted that Solowinski's Rules for Radicals was a featured item on the National Education Association reading list. And I reminded folks of the Weather Underground's terrorist and FOO, Friends of Obama's Bill Ayers, 2006 speech at a Washington Economic Forum in Caracas, Venezuela, in which he declared education the motor force of revolution while singing dictator Hugo Chavez's praises. I documented the radical activism of President Obama's White House teaching fellows, the overzealousness of public school educators who have turned classrooms into Obama campaign offices, and the influence of the left-wing socialist justice crusaders of Chicago's Ambridge Challenge on Team Obama, and the activist tradition of government schools using students as junior lobbyists to pressure legislators for higher education spending, pro-illegal immigration protests, gay marriage, and environmental propaganda, and of course, anti-war causes. And I've been telling you about more and more rank-and-file teachers speaking out as a result of their union activities. Well, here's one more. One teacher says, or writes, or wrote, "I've been a teacher for 32 plus years, retired several years, and I'm stuck in the union dues. I dislike most of the union activities and usually throw out their papers. And this one caught my attention. Instead of having dinner, I copied this thing with outrage. You have to read the cover of the paper." And it says, oh my goodness, "Defend what matters. Educate, collaborate, and agitate." This is what the unions have come down to. More in teachers' unions. Instead of teaching our kids reading, writing, and arithmetic, they're now taking time out to defend what matters. Not education. No, it's to educate, collaborate, and agitate. It's more about power than teaching nowadays. It's more about gaining power and indoctrination. It's not about teaching our kids how to become productive citizens. It's not about preparing children for college. It's about indoctrinating them into a system that will benefit socialist unions everywhere. Moving on. You know, I read an article today about billions in redundancy, wasted spending, money being spent uselessly and needlessly by the government. Does anyone recall the 80s where there was widespread reports of the government spending $750 for a hammer, $300 to $800 for a toilet seat, pencils and paper costing hundreds of dollars, a flashlight? The government bought flashlights for $250 each. This was in the 1980s, folks. So here we are not surprised that the U.S. government has 15 different agencies overseeing food safety laws. 15 different agencies. more than 20 separate programs to help the homeless and 80 programs for economic development. And these are just a few of the findings in a massive study of overlapping and duplicate programs that cost you and me, the taxpayer, billions of dollars each year. According to the Government Accountability Office, who they released a report today, a report from the nonpartisan GAO, Government Accountability Office, compiles a list of redundant and potentially ineffective federal programs. Is there a surprise here? Not at all. And this report could serve as a template for lawmakers in both parties as they move to cut federal spending and consolidate programs to reduce the deficit. Senator Tom Coburn, Republican of Oklahoma, who pushed for the report, estimated it identifies between 100 billion and 200 billion in duplicate spending. Wow. The GAO examined numerous federal agencies, including the Departments of Defense, Agriculture, and Housing and Urban Development, and pointed to instances where different arms of the government should be coordinating and consolidating efforts to save taxpayer money. The agency found 82 federal programs to improve teacher quality, 80 to help disadvantaged people with transportation, 47 for job training and employment, and 56 to help people understand finances. Instances of ineffective and unfocused federal programs can lead to a mismatch of occasional arbitrary policies and rules. Well, no secret here. The government is a mess. The government can't find its ass with both hands. And President Obama is the leader of these long list of morons. The report also says that there are 18 federal programs that spend a combined $62.5 billion. My personal favorite is that there is a federal agency that is responsible for the egg if you buy it and it's in its shell and there's a problem with it. And a separate federal agency that is responsible for the egg if there's a problem with it after you crack it. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, really. There is a federal agency that oversees poultry, and then there is a federal agency that oversees beef. There is a federal agency that oversees beef when it is after it has been slaughtered and prepared, and there is a federal agency that oversees it when it's a cow walking around going moo. You cannot make this stuff up. I'm not making it up. It's crazy. The world is going to hell. And we're just along for the ride. I mean, are you kidding? Is anyone surprised? Okay, now on to something a little bit more serious. Alexander Zinovy wrote a book under the old Soviet Union called The Yawning Heights. He used it to describe almost obscenely the speeches of Communist Party boss Leonid Brezhnev. The Russian word or words for glistening and yawning are very close, and with Comrade Leonid Brezhnev's drunken slurring, the glistening heights of socialism, to which he was forever summoning his chained people to, well, come out. Now, President Obama is no drunk. And we're not yet a captive people, but President Obama is becoming a bore. It's not his fault. It's socialism's fault. Irish poet Oscar Wilde was once asked what he thought of world socialism. Wilde archly replied, "I think it would consume too many evenings." He was right about that. Socialism politicizes everything. Literature, medicine, science, law, education, culture, religion, sports, all of life. And that ultimately makes socialism a crushing bore. President Obama is finding that tens of millions of Americans have tuned him out as he summons us to the heights. His audience for the State of the Union address is down 18% this year over his first year. Part of his, well, part of this is his speechwriter, a 29-year-old who seems never to have had any contact with literature, American history, poetry, or the Bible. The speeches he crafts for the president are textbook examples. 2 million people gathered 2 years ago on the Mall to hear President Obama take the oath of office. It was assuredly an historic moment. But now, barely 25 months later, can anyone, supporter or opponent, recall a single memorable line from Obama's inaugural address? Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. Did he say that? Mr. Obama also has suffered from the 24/7 news cycle. Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats were offered sparingly because FDR knew that the presidency was a precarious national resource. And he did not squander that resource. His major speeches were carefully crafted for maximum effect. Now compare Mr. Obama at Normandy with Ronald Reagan at the same location 25 years earlier. Reagan spoke movingly of the boys of Point Du Hoc, or our historic Rangers, in cadence that gave echoes of Henry at Gettysburg. Mr. Obama was said by Newsweek's Evan Thomas to hover over the nations at Normandy like a god. Awesome. But what did he say there? Hand our leader a foreign crisis like Libya, What does the president have to say about that? He said, this violence is unacceptable. Wow. We don't need a $400,000 a year commander-in-chief and his $172,000 a year speechwriter to tell us that the violence in Libya is unacceptable. Do we? He's not the only war leader with this problem. For all the hoopla about the movie The King's Speech, I doubt that any ticket buyers can quote a single line of that much-labored over-radio address. His Majesty overcomes his stammer by the grace of God, but brings forth a rhetorical mouse. Mr. Obama is still a charismatic figure. Of that there is no doubt. He has a deep, sonorous voice. He shares this much with FDR, CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow, and Hollywood star Humphrey Bogart. Those smokers all had wonderful speaking voices, didn't they? The way he speaks would be truly marvelous if he had anything even remotely interesting to say. But because Mr. Obama is boring, does not mean he will not be reelected. The media will do its best to puff anything he says or does, and the GOP is making noise about the charisma of competence. Try to imagine a scintillating evening in the company of Richard Nixon. Listen to those tapes, if you dare. Jerry Ford may have taken the prize as the most boring president, but he came within a whisker of being reelected in 1976. He was up against Jimmy Carter, who nobody would ever accuse of being a stimulating conversationalist. Governor Mitch Daniels wants us all to get over Ronald Reagan. Part of Reagan's appeal to America in general and to conservatives in particular is that he was a great communicator. He modestly said it had been his privilege to communicate great ideas. He quoted the founders more than any of the four presidents before him, and more than any of the four presidents who came after him. Maybe the reason Reagan was so great is that he didn't think himself great. When Ted Kennedy toasted Democratic wise man Avril Herman, the Massachusetts Political said Herman at 90 was not so old. Ronald Reagan graciously responded to the jibe with thanks to the senator. The Constitution is almost 200 years old, and that's where I get my ideas, Reagan said. What we have here, folks, is a president who simply is boring. We're starting to get over the idea that we have a God for a president, that we have a deity, that we have a president who is above mere mortals, a president who stands out, a man among boys, a president for the ages. We're starting to get the idea that our great president is just a man, just an ordinary man, no longer a god. Was he ever a god? No. He was simply boring. No doubt. The day, March 1st, 2011, planet Earth, third planet from the sun, and the day
the following is a fictional story of events
the dollar died.
In the near future. 8 a.m., New York Stock Exchange. It's a cold, breezy day on Wall Street as markets await the Federal Reserve's announcement for QE4. Futures are up significantly. The Dow Jones just breached its 2008 high of 14,164. Gold just hit an all-time high of 2,900. Silver just breached $100 per ounce. The dollar index is holding at 53. With official unemployment at 16.3%, there's a nervous feeling on Wall Street that if this doesn't work, the world could implode into a depression that will last for the remainder of the decade. 8:19 a.m., Beijing. Chinese officials announced that they can no longer allow Washington to devalue their holdings. After making their concerns private, China accepts that Washington will never stop paying its debt with inflated currency. China makes an official statement from Beijing. Quote, "We have made our concerns known privately for some time. With QE4 about to be announced today, China will have no choice but to stop purchasing U.S. treasuries. We have allowed Washington to try to work through their imbalances for 4 years. But with global inflation and U.S. consumers rapidly shrinking as a percentage of global GDP, we feel that a Western recovery is unlikely until they reform their entitlement programs." 8:45 a.m., New York Stock Exchange. Upon hearing the statement from China, Dow futures have a sharp reversal and begin to drop. Gold leaps past $3,000 per ounce, up $150 per ounce in the last 26 minutes. CNBC awaits a statement from the White House. 8:50 a.m., Washington, D.C. The president makes an official statement to calm investors' fears. He tells Americans that he has spoken with several G20 leaders. They have assured him that they will continue to increase their purchase of treasuries and believe that a strong U.S. economy is the only thing that will bring back global prosperity. He has also spoken to Chairman Bernanke, who assures him that a strong dollar will be the result of QE4. The president also reminds Americans that his recent New Deal recovery program that he passed through executive order to increase the likelihood of a lasting recovery. He also notes that Beijing, since 2009, has slowly been reducing their holdings, so the impact will be minimal. 9:51 a.m., New York. Dow futures fall 850 points in the first 20 minutes of trading. Markets are halted for 1 hour by the authorities. 10 a.m., Main Street, America. The news about the stock market in China has now spread. A panic begins to set in, and unprepared Americans rush to the grocery store. In an attempt to purchase food and water, Americans that didn't know what was going on are alerted by all of the news stories and panic buying. Within 50 minutes, there is a nationwide rush to the stores. Empty store shelves in America become a reality. 10:52 a.m., New York. Markets reopen and the Dow Jones resumes its collapse. Investors around the world join the sell-off in bonds and stocks and begin to purchase commodities. Unlike the panic of 2008, this time commodities are seen as the only safe haven from a dollar crisis. 11:30 a.m., New York. The Dow falls 1,700 points since reopening. Trading is halted for at least 2 hours. The Federal Reserve injects $200 billion into the market and announces that QE4 will be delayed until further notice. Congress is called back to D.C. for an emergency joint session. Some members of Congress are saying that they consider China's statement a financial attack. 12 p.m., Main Street, America. Several cities begin to see civil unrest after grocery stores are forced to close. Traffic in the streets and violence break out. The president puts the National Guard on alert for a possible deployment onto U.S. streets if things don't get under control soon. Several news agencies are reporting injuries at grocery chains and call for the authorities to do something before it gets worse. 12:15 p.m., Toronto, Canada. George Soros tells CNBC that a run on treasuries is imminent and that there's nothing the government can do to stop it. He says it is unfortunate that a controlled decline of the dollar was not coordinated better over the years. Today really could have been avoided if not for the Tea Party politicians who demanded fiscal responsibility and a constitutional government. 3 p.m., gold closes at $11.53 for the day at $4,053 per ounce. Silver closes at $173 per ounce. The president announces that due to civil unrest in some areas of the country, U.S. stock markets will remain closed for the rest of the day. With the exception of mining and other inflation-related stocks, the majority of U.S. stocks are down significantly due to the sell-off and flight to safety in commodities. The Federal Reserve announces that it will begin to purchase U.S. treasuries and stocks in order to stabilize the market. But this only feeds investors' fears of a full-blown treasury run and collapse of the dollar. 6 p.m., Asia. Asian markets begin a massive sell-off. Dollar collapse rumors begin to take hold of the market. CNBC Asia looks into a possible comic default and complete breakdown in the U.S. economy. Gold spikes in Asia, up 17.50 in the first complete hour of trading. Gold is now at 58.03. 7 p.m., gold and silver bullion dealers across the world have suspended all sales due to no inventory. A comic default is now expected. Several central bank representatives propose a freeze on currency markets and a fixed devaluation of the U.S. dollar in order to calm investors. 7:30 p.m., the United States. The sun sets on America. In the last 12 hours, the world has changed. Americans are glued to their televisions, taking a crash course on a debauched currency. Smoke from fires in the cities have put a dark cloud over the nation. 7:45, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve announces it will inject $1.5 trillion into the markets in order to stop any further decline in stocks. 7:55 p.m., OPEC. The final nail in the coffin. OPEC nations halt oil trades in U.S. dollars until further notice. They will only accept euros, renminbi, or gold. 7:59 p.m., the Federal Reserve's announcement to inject $1.5 trillion into the markets causes a sharp reversal in overseas markets. Stocks begin to rally even as Main Street melts down. 8 p.m., Manhattan. Gerard Adams, president of the National Inflation Association, sends out an urgent email alert. In it, he informs members that it is with great sadness that the time to warn and prepare Americans for hyperinflation has ended.
Get yourself informed. The scenario, the day the dollar died, is not far-fetched. We have seen and we feel this scenario coming to pass every single day. The rising cost of all our commodities, gasoline, basic food items, milk, cheese, bread, gold is skyrocketing. I bought gold at less than $100. Now it's what? I think it's like 140 an ounce. The world is collapsing. The world is sinking deeper and deeper into chaos. Watch the news. Just take a few minutes. Try an unbiased station with not much of an agenda. I won't say no agenda. Try Fox News. Even ABC, NBC, and CBS, and yes, CNN and MSNBC, they report the news, and of course they put their own slant on it, but you can read between the lines. America is no longer the last hope for the world, the best hope for the world. The day the dollar died. Can you see it? Did you listen? Were you listening to the YouTube video of the day the dollar died? I just played it. I found it to be creepy and frightening. and all too true. The interesting part, the parts of the video, were the ones that are coming to pass right now. Right now. Exactly. He got 30 to 45 seconds. The last World War I veteran died. And he didn't, he got barely a mention. I'm not so sure that he was even mentioned much in the mainstream media. But think about what's going on here in this country when we scarcely honor our last World War I veteran. But even deeper, what's happening to our country? The day the dollar died is not so far off. The price of gold and platinum and silver is skyrocketing. The confidence in U.S. leadership and solvency is at an all-time low. There is no confidence in our president. There's no respect. He's neither respected nor feared, which is a serious problem for this great, once great nation. I'm gravely concerned for what the future holds for the United States of America. Is this time? Is this our time? Caller, you're on the
air. Yeah, well, hello.
Hello.
Fred here. How you doing? I didn't realize I was on live.
Hey. What do you have to say?
Well, you hit the nail on the head with the news departments. 45 seconds for the last World War I vet. They don't care anything more than what they really want to carry. I mean, NBC should have, NBC, CBS, or ABC should be doing a special. Now, I realize he died Sunday. And it would take a day or two to put the special together. But, I mean, they should have a special ready.
Well, exactly. And I've been told, it's my understanding that there are obituaries and that sort of thing ready for almost, most public figures, just in case.
Yeah. I mean, Frank.
He was 110 years old. There should have been something put together for that occasion. It's morbid in some circles, but certainly it's appropriate here.
Yes, I mean Frank never wanted to. Well, Frank, I've spoken with Frank Buckles.
Mm-hmm.
Bless his soul.
Wow.
I've had that honor and privilege. I actually spoke with his daughter a little bit more than him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. He never really wanted to be the last veteran of World War I, but he knew that he was going to be close to the end of the veterans because he enlisted at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
He lied about his age to get in, so he knew he was going to be one of the closest, and as he says, if he could do it over again, he would.
Yes, I read about him. I had no idea that, unfortunately, and it's embarrassing to say that I did not know of him. But I read all about him, and as soon as I saw on Fox on Fox's website from the Fox Nation that he had passed away, and I saw pictures of him as a young man, and then and just there toward the end, I was very, very much moved by the tribute that Fox gave to him and by his story. And it's sad for me that the President of the United States didn't, you know, I'm not picking on him for this, really.
No, he's already signed, Barack Obama has already signed a presidential executive order ordering all U.S. flags to be flown at half staff on day of internment.
Wonderful. That is
okay.
Good news. Now, when did
you
do that?
I, as much as people hate to say it, he's already hate Obama. I have to step in and say he's done that already.
Well, that is wonderful news. Finally, he's done something.
Okay. I mean, he did that yesterday.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Now the problem is with the House and Senate. The two bills are sitting in the House and Senate. One is House Continuing Resolution 23, and the other is Senate Continuous Resolution 5. Both would authorize the use of the Capitol Rotunda for, well, Frank Buckles to lie in state, not so much as Frank Buckles, but as the last World War One veteran.
Of course.
Okay, and Congress is playing around with them. They're sitting in committees. Any listeners out there need to get out and call their congressmen and senators, tell them to co-sponsor the bill and find out why it ain't getting through.
Indeed.
It's h.con.res.23. That's the House Continuing Resolution version. And the Senate is s.con.res.5. You can Google them and find the bill. Just watch out that you got the right Congress.
Got it.
Okay. These bills do not need the presidential signature because it's the House and Senate that controls the use of the Capitol building. All
exactly.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll get on this myself tomorrow as well, and get a lot of my friends and colleagues involved as well.
Call the leadership too. Call the leaders in the different places and say, "Why is this bill being held up?"
Yeah, there isn't time to dither around with this with these resolutions. It's time to get that moving because time is running out.
Yep.
And the last World War One veteran should hold that special place, that honor.
I will say President Bush, the second Bush, people complain about him, but he did an executive order as Commander-in-Chief authorizing Frank Buckles to be buried in Arlington Cemetery because he did not have the criteria of awards to be buried there.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
At the time, there was three remaining World War One veterans in the U.S. One was a Canadian World War One vet of the Canadian military living in the U.S.
I had no idea. Well, thank you very much. It's been you've enlightened me a great deal, and certainly anyone who's listening as well, sure. Thank you very much for the call, sir. We're running out of time.
Have a good day.
It's time to go. You too. Have a good evening, and God bless you. Okay. Well, he heard the man. Make the calls. I'll start doing it tomorrow myself. It's important. Time's running out. The last World War One veteran. It got me to thinking about whether or not I'll be here for the last World War Two veteran. It got me thinking about a lot. Well, time's running out. We had a great caller call in and give us some information about how we can honor the last World War One veteran. And think about the day the dollar dies and how we can stop it. What we can do. Thank you very much for listening, and good night. God bless you.